Hello, I'm Robert Cartwright, Vice Chairman of the Institute of Classical Osteopathy. We're a postgraduate education organisation who help osteopaths become better osteopaths. The Institute was started in 1954 by John Wernham and T.E. Hall to preserve the osteopathy of the early pioneer osteopaths such as Andrew Taylor Still and John Martin Littlejohn and others. We promote osteopathy as it is and was supposed to be, a principle-led art and science. We help osteopaths explore this to gain a deeper understanding of the osteopathic principles and osteopathic thinking. This is a fascinating subject which helps osteopaths' development, which in turn helps them help more of their patients, which is why, at the end of the day, we all do this. If you'd like further information about our courses, please go to our website at www.classical-osteopathy.org. So just a brief recap from the first of this series about lesion research. I do use the word lesion as it is less of a mouthful than somatic dysfunction, although it is a bit antiquated. So we have to remember that osteopathy developed as an alternative healthcare system to the treatments of the day back in the beginning of the 20th century and the late 19th century. Rather than the MSK pain treatment that is mainly taught at undergraduate level today. Andrew Taylor Still and John Martin Littlejohn were the first to conduct research regarding the pathogenesis of the osteopathic lesion, and this was then developed upon by Carl McConnell, who experimented on dogs over a six-year period with an assistant. Dogs were lesioned under anaesthesia. There was no direct tissue damage and the dogs were observed for 30 to 80 days after lesioning before any autopsy was performed where samples were collected. From these experiments, McConnell concluded that 1. The osteopathic lesion was something more than an effect at the foramen. 2. Initially, there was a physiological disturbance of the muscular, fascial, ligamentous and osseous tissues, which causes interference with normal afferentation to the spinal cord centres, which is more or less permanently maintained by the lack of freedom of the joint movements. 3. This initiates changes to the spinal cord at the level of the segment and to a lesser degree the segments of the cord above and below. 4. The interference to that constant afferent feedback system disturbs function of vasomotor and other centres. 5. Vessel dilation and congestion is a prominent feature. 6. The arterioles, capillaries and veins are pathologically affected by the disturbed innervation. The bloodstream is slowed, the endothelial tissue is compromised and plasma exudation takes place. This is followed by diapedesis leading to small areas of hemorrhage, especially in and around the nerve centres of the cord and the ganglia. Thus, nutrition is jeopardised and causes parenchymatous degeneration. 7. The neural tissue is greatly affected, especially the ganglia from the cord to the sympathetics and connective tissues, which are richly supplied by blood. The greatest disturbance seems to be in the nerve centres. 8. Many lesions, if not all, affect the health of the tissue and visceral structures innervated and related to them, therefore acting as an etiological predisposing or maintaining factor to disease processes. Louisa Burns was the dominant osteopathic researcher of the first half of the 20th century. She rigorously followed the scientific method and, interestingly, was sometimes criticised for it. Throughout the duration of her research on the effect of artificially induced lesions on the neurologically related end tissues, she demonstrated there followed a common sequelae. Her experiments were corroborated and repeated by other researchers independently. The summary of these effects, or the effects of these lesions produced, were initial but brief vasospasm causing ischemia, fatigue of the reflex causing dilation of the arterioles. This is followed by passive congestion leading to inflammation of the affected tissue. The longer-term sequelae of this was infiltration of fibrous tissue and hypertension. And the long-term outcome effect of this in all areas of the spine was ischemia in the neurologically related structures related to the end tissues and visceral structures related to those tissues. This in itself didn't cause pathology but rendered the tissues in a pre-pathological state, making them susceptible to pathology, or in the absence of this, over longer periods of time, degeneration or degenerative changes. This was one of the key components to Still's osteopathy, improving the health of end tissues, allowing homeostasis to re-establish itself, and is a good example of the related principles, which are the inseparable relationship between structure and function, and the body having the capacity to self-heal given the right environment. Part of that recovery is enabled by helping re-establish circulation and drainage, which is rule of the artery, which in fact was the rule of the artery is supreme, and any obstruction to it marks the day, hour, and minute of when disease starts, or something like that. Perhaps it was inevitable that John Steadman Denslow, DO, would be a pivotal figure in osteopathic history and research, because he married into the Still family, marrying Blanche Still's daughter. From an early age in his career, Denslow realised that there was a need for more scholarly academic research to underpin the profession. Whilst this wasn't a new idea, the financial means to carry out research or carry research forward wasn't available. Denslow also did spend time working at Sunny Slopes laboratories for Louisa Burns as a researcher. So to get the research ball rolling, he needed funding. Denslow initially approached the Carnegie Corporation of New York to start the process of acquiring research funding to establish osteopathy in the world of scholarly medicine. These initial efforts were unsuccessful, but he made some useful contacts within the medical research field. These new contacts would have proved helpful after the first application of funds were refused because osteopathy was a bit of a political hot potato. It was recommended that Denslow meet with a Dr. Alan Gregg, the Director of Medical Sciences at the Rockefeller Foundation, who was considered a bit of a maverick. Denslow and a Dr. McBain, who was the then president of the Chicago College of Osteopathic Medicine, met with Dr. Gregg for a long lunch. Dr. Gregg suggested that they should study, research and publish the basic biological mechanisms of osteopathic theory and methods. So their research group decided to go with Dr. Gregg's advice, and Denslow developed a program based upon his osteopathic clinical experience and to explore the biological foundations of osteopathy. This was the first contact for osteopaths with independently established investigators in the international scientific community. So Denslow realized that to do this research, he not only had to be an expert at the field he was researching, but he also had to be expert in the research methods and methodology that would be used. And he found that it took 2 to 3 years of additional training for him and his colleagues to become sufficiently skilled in the required techniques and methodology to be helpful in the project. And as a result of making these new scientific contacts through Dr. Gregg, Denslow was able to work with several world-renowned scientists who he studied with for the next 2 years. Denslow knew that with his palpation skills that he had learned and developed as an osteopath, he could readily find areas of muscles and joints in people's spines whose range of movement and tissue tone was different to other areas, and that these were signs of the osteopathic spinal lesion to osteopaths. This led to a hypothesis that the use of the relatively new science of electromyography, or EMG, would be able to objectify and measure these changes in tissue tone in comparison to what were considered the non-lesioned areas. So based on the new understanding of the single motor unit activity in muscle fibers, Denslow was able to apply this to research into the osteopathic lesion, as one of the characteristics was the palpable difference in the texture of the tissues which support, protect and move synovial joints. Hence, it was theorized that some of the palpable tissue differences were due to change in reflex muscle contraction. Thus, using EMG, it should be possible to demonstrate the difference in reflex muscle contraction in the lesioned areas versus an absence of muscle contraction in the non-lesioned areas. This hypothesis was found to be partly correct. Denslow spoke to the Kirksville College of Osteopathic Medicine about this, and a big investment was made to build new labs fitted with EMG machines, all sorts of electronic amplification equipment and high-end kit, including a shielded or Faraday room, which at the time were relatively state-of-the-art and sophisticated for the group's research projects. The initial research design included the selection by palpation of lesioned and non-lesioned areas in human subjects. These were students from Kirksville. One coaxial electrode was inserted into the lesioned area and one in the normal area. Simultaneous recordings were made of the muscle activity, and it was found that the lesioned area had a higher degree of reflex activity and little or no contraction in the non-lesioned areas. In this way, they could record an increase in muscle activity in 21 of the 25 experiments. This increased activity could be elicited by a number of stimuli, which were not effective in producing the same action potentials in adjacent or non-lesion segments. By 1941, the research team had become well-trained and experienced electromyographers. However, they noticed that during the process of getting someone comfortable and relaxed after the needle sensors were inserted, which sometimes took the help of pillows and bolsters and some changes in positions, that the reflex muscle contraction at the lesion would disappear, and the EMG differential between the lesion and non-lesion area was lost. The reflex muscle contraction was still present, but it had moved to a different part of the muscle, so the needles had to be withdrawn and reinserted. I wonder if the research subjects who were, as I said, were usually students, realise what they'd put themselves up for at this point, as it all sounds pretty painful. Mind you, they did use local anaesthetic, but I'm sure they would have been pretty sore after that had worn off. When the electrodes were inserted in the non-lesion areas, this not surprisingly produced a brief flurry of action potentials lasting about 15 to 30 seconds, which they called insertion potentials. However, when the electrodes were inserted through muscle in lesion areas, the insertion potentials continued for longer periods. When the potentials subsequently died out, moving the electrodes very slightly would reinitiate these insertion potentials or action potentials. This was a phenomenon that did not occur in the normal non-lesion areas. At a later stage in the research, it was found that other irritations, for example, stimulation of the skin chemically with drops of ether and mechanically with pin scratches or with pressure on spinous processes, initiated contraction in lesion areas, but again, not in the non-lesion areas. Denslow and his colleagues found that when a major set of afferent impulses reached a given spinal cord segment from whatever source, one of two things happened at the affected motor nerve cells. Either the motor cells were activated and muscle contraction occurred, or the cells were placed in a state of partial or subliminal excitation, which was referred to as a central excitatory state or facilitation. When the central excitatory state was present, another set of afferent impulses could be added to the original impulses from the lesion area, and the motor cells supplying the lesion area were then activated by the two sets of stimulus that were ineffective at a non-lesion segment. This is because the motor nerve cells in the lesion area were already partially excited, so they were in a hyper-excitable state and they needed less stimulus to be triggered to cause action potential. This was the pioneering work of central sensitization of the central nervous system. This work was published in the Journal of Neurophysiology, and the results can be summarized as: 1. Lesioned areas associated with postural changes or strain commonly show spontaneous action potentials. 2. When such spontaneous activity is absent, it can be induced by suitable stimuli, and this is a useful criteria for detecting lesion areas. 3. Induced reflex activity is probably dependent on the presence of an enduring central excitatory state plus an accessory subliminal stimulus. From this study, Denslow was able to be the first to objectively measure the effects of the presence of a lesion and publish this in a peer-reviewed journal. The research team was slowly building the biological evidence that there was central sensitization or facilitation being caused by the lesion process. This initial research project was due to be published in 1941 in the Journal of Neurophysiology, which was one of the most prestigious journals of its type in the world. But unfortunately, the editor, who supported the work but felt he couldn't allow the article to be accepted from an osteopathic institution because of the politics of the time. So the Kirksville Research Group, that was called, snappily, the Biomechanics Laboratory of the Kirksville College of Osteopathic Medicine, was renamed as the Still Memorial Research Trust. Perhaps they just didn't have enough space in the journal to get the first name in. Anyway, using this name, the group was able to publish their research until they were sufficiently well recognized in the prestigious medically controlled journals before letting it be known that the research was from an osteopathic institution. This removed the association to osteopathy, as it was a controversial and most editorial referees were not really that familiar with the osteopathic profession, and it wasn't taken particularly seriously. After it was noticed that pressure over a spinous process could stimulate measurable action potentials in a lesioned area and less so in a non-lesioned area, the next task was to develop equipment that was able to apply an objectively measured external stimulus and record the amount of stimulus being produced. So a pressure meter was designed and developed, which could apply a force from 1 to 7 kilograms in 1 kilogram increments. The earliest version of the pressure meter was a large, cumbersome device which went through several stages of development. What they found most of the time was that the lesioned areas had a lowered threshold, so the more severe lesions might produce action potentials at up to 3 kilograms of pressure, whereas a non-lesioned site wouldn't respond to 7 kilograms of pressure. There are pictures of this pressure meter which they developed at Kirksville, and it looks like a massive syringe that they're giving people injections into their spine with, and until you read about what it is. The research team published several papers over the next couple of years between 1941 and 1945, which was when Irvin Kaur, who was a PhD, ended up in Kirksville. Now, I often wondered why a relatively unfashionable institution without a huge amount of credibility or money was able to attract a real rising star of the scientific world like Kaur. This was because when Kaur was an undergraduate physiology student at New York Medical School, he was approached by two students who he really admired. They told him that they thought, with his mind and attitude, he should join the Communist Party. The philosophy of this party was explained to him, and it seemed rational. There was no mention of revolution, overthrowing governments, violence or war. It was a very acceptable philosophy about equality among races, with no discrimination, and that poverty should be outlawed, and nobody should be poor or wealthy. Also, lots of the distinguished medical faculty were members. Dr. Kaur was a well-connected young scientist, having known Albert Einstein, who was the professor of maths at Princeton, where Kaur did his PhD, and having played in a musical ensemble with the famous physicist. But during World War II, the US government needed scientists like Kaur, as their technology was behind the European countries, and his specific skills and previous research was needed. All government employees were investigated, but his background was overlooked because of his research and scientific skills and knowledge. But during the post-World War II period in America, anti-communist paranoia was whipped up during the Truman presidency. After the war, Senator McCarthy thought Kaur was a security threat for his pre-war membership of the Communist Party. His stance as a conscientious objector to World War II and his anti-war statements. When the war was over and scientists like Kaur were returning to civilian life, this made him a controversial figure. And Dr. Kaur, because of his classification as a security threat, was too controversial. No one wanted to employ him anymore. He applied for many academic positions, and there were various institutions that wanted him, but he kept getting rejected after meeting with these educational research organisations and was told that if they employed him, they'd lose some of their grant money. One of Kaur's contacts was Dr. Alan Gregg of the Rockefeller Foundation. And you'll probably remember him. He was the chap who was considered a maverick and suggested the direction which Denslow should take his research in. He discussed with Waugh that he had been getting some interesting research information from a Dr. Stedman Denslow of Kirksville. Kirksville College of Osteopathic Medicine interviewed Dr. Kaur for a research position and hired him. I'm sure they probably ripped his arm off when they realised that he was happy to work for them. As he had a wife and a young family and he needed money, and no one else would employ him, he went to Kirksville. Kaur joined Kirksville College of Osteopathic Medicine in 1945, and he only planned to stay for a year until the heat died down and he could go somewhere else. But he found the research at Kirksville so fascinating and osteopathy so fascinating, he stayed there for 30 years. Kaur played a major role in the developing or organising idea and research into the osteopathic lesion. From their previous research, the group, which included new boy Irvin Kaur, knew that these areas of facilitation existed in the central nervous system. What was not known was which elements in the spinal reflex accounted for the facilitation, nor did they have quantitative information concerning how much facilitation might be present. So the following experiment was designed. 1. Recording electrodes were inserted in the paravertebral muscles opposite T4, T6, T8 and T10. These electrodes were connected to an 8-channel EMG. Thus, it was possible to record simultaneously muscle action potentials that might or might not be present at each recording site. 2. The pressure meter was applied at increments of 1 kilogram until the top level, 7 kilograms, was reached without initiating contraction, or until contraction was recorded at the segment being stimulated at a lower level. 3. This was a cumbersome and time-consuming process, i.e. setting the pressure meter at 1 kilogram, then 2 kilogram, etc., until 7 kilograms was applied without initiating contraction. Each segment was palpated prior to the stimulation. The absence or presence and degree of lesion was predicted and recorded on the basis of the differences of the supraspinous tissues found during palpation, and the pressure meter was set accordingly. The predictions proved to be remarkably accurate. I think he said probably about 80%. In 1947, the results of the research were published in the American Journal of Physiology under the title Quantitative Studies of Chronic Facilitation in Human Motor Neuron Pools, and the findings may be briefly summarised as follows. A low-pressure stimulus from the pressure meter at the lesion sites caused action potentials, whereas a large stimulus at non-lesion sites produced little or no action potential or muscle contraction. In addition to this, in individuals with both lesioned and non-lesioned areas, stimulus at the non-lesioned segments, whilst not causing a local contraction, would cause a muscle contraction at the lesion segment. This occurred even if the supraspinous tissues at the facilitated segment were anaesthetized with procaine. This and other observations suggested that the facilitation involved the interneurons or motor neurons in the spinal cord or both. When palpated, the tissues of the lesion segments felt thickened or swollen in contrast to those of the non-lesion segments, and the bony outlines were different. The difference between the tissues was sufficient for an accurate guess of how facilitated the segment was. Experienced examiners were able to guess what pressure would require to cause reflex muscle contraction from palpating the supraspinous tissues with an accuracy of about 87.5%. And the other 12.5% were only one category out, or so they were very close. So palpation in this situation was actually pretty accurate because they weren't using students to palpate things, they were using experienced examiners. Thus, an experienced examiner could predict on the basis of physical examination the absence or presence and degree of spinal cord facilitation. This provided an important diagnostic evaluation regardless of the type or location of the pathology which accounts for the facilitation. Application of the pressure meter was usually painful at the lesion segments and not painful at the non-lesion segments. After repeated stimulation, the spinous processes at facilitated segments frequently remained tender for more than 24 hours. This tenderness did not occur at the non-facilitated segments. Their comments on the characteristics that account for their observations of the supraspinous tissues at facilitated segments were: 1. They have a low reflex threshold. 2. Can be identifiable on physical examination. And 3. Can be tender, part of the physical examination, I would expect. However, since two of the characteristics of inflammation, namely swelling and pain, are involved, it was suspected that this disturbance is similar to a chronic inflammatory process brought about by the lesion process. In summary, facilitated segments showed low reflex threshold, tissue changes on palpation, pressure produced pain, tissues were susceptible to minor trauma. Non-facilitated segments showed high reflex threshold, no tissue changes on palpation, pressure does not produce pain, and tissues not susceptible to minor trauma. What was initially an idea to process and organise the data accrued by 1947 and to review where the research group were with their understanding of chronic segmental facilitation. Core wrote his thoughts down, and this ended up being developed into a presentation at the American Osteopathic Association conference in July 1947. This presentation was also published in the Journal of the American Osteopathic Association in December 1947, and this was one of Core's most important contributions to osteopathy, and it was called The Neural Basis of the Osteopathic Lesion. The summary of this work was as follows. 1. The osteopathic lesion is associated with a section of the spinal cord which has a low motor threshold, meaning facilitated. 2. The lowered motor threshold affects the spinous process but isn't caused by the spinous process, even though they can be used as a diagnostic tool. Their sensitivity is secondary to the facilitation of the cord structures. 3. This lesion segment can be affected by stimulus at the segment or from nearby segments. 4. The lesion therefore represents a segment on which irritation is focused, a place in the cord where inhibition to motor neuron excitation has been lowered and impulses into muscles and other neurologically related structures are increased. There are also other notable features: alteration in tissue texture over the spinous process, lowered pain threshold and increased susceptibility to trauma. It was surmised that it was probably that these changes in texture are due to local changes in vasomotor activity, fluid balance, capillary permeability, trophic factors, and other features which are directly or indirectly under the influence of the lateral horn cells of the sympathetic nervous system, which are affected by the lesion. What was also found was: 1. Tissue texture changes are closely related to the degree of lowered motor reflex threshold. This is how the researching osteopaths were able to guess how much pressure it would take to stimulate a motor response. Again, an experienced osteopath. 2. Pain threshold was lowered. It was easier to reach the consciousness of the patient, meaning the cerebral cortex, through the lesion segment rather than the non-lesion segment. This was interpreted as signifying a facilitation of the spinothalamic fibres. 3. Susceptibility to trauma or mechanical irritation to the lesion segments may stay painful for several days, whereas the same stimulus to a non-lesion segment was not so bothersome. Characteristics of the osteopathic lesion are: 1. In the non-lesion segment, motor neurons are usually inhibited from firing until a high enough threshold of stimulus, or facilitation, is reached by the convergence from other neural impulses. This serves to reduce aberrant firing and acts as a kind of insulation from this. 2. In the lesion segment, this descending inhibition is weakened, and a large proportion of the motor neurons are kept near the firing point and therefore are triggered at much lower levels of afferent stimulus. from any segmentally or neurologically related structure or stimulus by other nearby lesioned or non-lesioned segments. 3. Proprioceptors are an important source of this bombardment, but any segmentally related structure such as viscera may be a source. 4. Due to the facilitation, the firing process of a motor neuron at the lesion segment may be completed by any or far fewer inputs than the non-lesion segment due to the loss of inhibiting insulation. 5. The state of facilitation may extend to all the neurons with their cell bodies in the segment of the cord related to the lesion, including the anterior horn cells, preganglionic fibers in the sympathetics and the spinothalamic fibers. 6. Because the lesion sensitizes the segment to all impulses from all sources, it should be considered as a neurological lens which focuses irritation on that segment rather than a radiating center of irritation, and therefore should be treated as such. 7. In neurophysiology, it was generally accepted that if something is excited, that something functionally related is inhibited. Therefore, facilitation at the lesion segment would also extend to neurons extending inhibitory influences over other neurons or organs. Kohl hypothesized that, assuming the proprioceptors were important in the lesion mechanism, it must be kept in mind that any segmentally related structure which sends afferents to the spinal cord may be an important participant in the establishment or maintenance of the lesion. In fact, through the network of interneurons, practically any afferent, segmentally related or not, will exert some influence. To all these sources of impulses must be added the suprasegmental sources, all the higher centres, from medulla to cerebral cortex, which contribute to the descending spinal tract motor impulses. Many of these are continuous and highly variable sources of impulses. They exert their influence, excitatory or inhibitory, upon efferent neurons at every level of the spinal cord. What Kohl was saying here is that we should consider that the efferent motor neurons act as the final common pathway shared by a host of impulse sources, in addition to the facet joints and their supporting structures. Because of this, it cannot be considered that the lesion is the cause of a disease, but one of the many factors happening simultaneously. The lesion is an important factor as it predisposes, localizes and channels sensitizing segments of the cord, lowering barriers and facilitates without necessarily producing symptoms. See Burns' work about the effect of lesions on the end tissues, predisposing them to disease, in which we've talked about in the Lesion Research Part 1 podcast. Signs of its presence are detected by osteopaths, and this broadens the importance of the osteopathic lesion and points to how it has an effect on general health and wellness. Osteopaths for the last 120-odd years have been familiar with this. To the osteopath, there is, of course, nothing unfamiliar in the practical aspects of this concept. Kohl mentions what we see at the clinical coalface. One patient might have relatively severe lesions, but is symptom and pain-free and not readily subject to problems associated with them. Another patient with very similar lesions may be subject to serious disturbances directly related to those lesions. Further, the lesions of the first patient may become symptomatic under certain circumstances and then subside into remission again. Kohl and his fellow researchers believe that implicit in the osteopathic concept is the differences in the amount of nervous excitation continually bombarding the efferent neurons of the lesion segments over and above that of from the muscles and the joints. Therefore, the lesion operates in different contexts, with different effects in different people. Kohl went on to say, given that the lesion determines the low threshold segments, then the severity of the lesion and the associated pathology and the response to treatment will often be dependent upon how much neuronal stimulus from other sources is chronically present above and beyond the input from the muscles and the joints again. This stimulus may be affecting all the segments, but due to the lowered threshold at the lesion site, the effects there will be exaggerated. Therefore, the lesion not only focuses the effect on the segment of the cord, but also magnifies any stresses or increased neuronal stimulus made by it. This superimposed stimulus may come from other sources which converge on the anterior horn cells and other efferent neurons such as the cortex, the basal ganglia, cerebellum, vestibular nuclei, bulbar center, the eyes via the tectospinal tracts, or any steady tonic source of impulses. Who was it who criticised Core for not considering the central nervous system beyond the dorsal horn? What a load of rubbish. Since all of these sources may directly affect, either positively or negatively, the lesion and its associated phenomena, they are all probably within the remit of the osteopath. All of them may contribute to the lesion and its effects on the total body economy. But important as the structural factor is, treatment of it alone is not treating the patient as a whole, and would be, if interpreted correctly, a corruption of the osteopathic concept. An example of this would be a patient with an anxiety state or going through a stressful situation. The effect on the cortex can increase motor activity, muscle tone and hyper-responsiveness in generally lowered reflex thresholds. This is due to impulses passing down the descending spinal tracts and affecting, directly or indirectly through the interneurons of the anterior horn cells, and increasing their excitability and activity. In a segment already sensitized by an osteopathic lesion, the effects will be especially severe. Just as important is the fact that descending impulses may exaggerate the lesion and produce an increased effects on the segmentally related organs, and may cause or intensify pain or make the lesion less responsive to manipulative therapy. To treat only the structural source of the bombardment is to only half treat and neglect a most important part of the lesion mechanism, and to take the lesion out of context. This does not mean that every osteopath has to be a psychiatrist, but they certainly must take into account consideration the home factors, the environmental factors, family relations, emotional adjustments, tensions, etc. The biopsychosocial approach isn't new. This is 1947, not 1977. But I digress. The connection between these states of stress and manifestations of pathologies such as angina, gastric and duodenal ulcers, asthma, etc., is the autonomic nervous system. Anything that directs, focuses or channels changes in blood flow or function to an end tissue may predispose towards pathology, and this is what the lesion does. One of the things Core has been criticised for is not involving the higher CNS, as if the researchers did not know it was there. We can see this is not the case just from actually reading the paper. In it, he mentions the anterior horn cells receiving impulses from sources such as the cerebral cortex, red nucleus, medulla oblongata, vestibular nuclei, cerebellum, the pons, superior colliculi, and other higher centres, which establish synaptic connections with anterior horn cells to organise control of voluntary motion, equilibrium, postural reflexes, visual spinal reflexes, etc. He also was aware of inhibitory as well as excitatory mechanisms and the dynamic balance of the nervous system, which responds to the current internal and external environments and volition. As this work progressed during the early years, which is what this part of Core and Denslow's research period is called, other investigators were recruited to join Dr. Core and Dr. Denslow. The research was expanded to include studies that dealt largely with relationships between the somatic system and the vascular and autonomic systems, and with certain viscera. The results of these experimentations studies were published in many, many journals. As a result, osteopaths began to contemplate the concepts of afferent bombardment of the central nervous system, facilitation, the role of the cerebral cortex, postural equilibrium centres, bulbar centres, cutaneous receptors, and others that can maintain a hyper-irritability state of the central nervous system. Though I'm not sure how many of these US osteopaths would have been aware of John Martin Littlejohn's assertion that all disease starts on the sensory side. In 1993, Denslow wrote an article for the Journal of the American Osteopathic Association and said, of this period in history, which he referred to as the early years, which I just mentioned, he said, the lessons that were learnt in the early years are just as valid now as they were then. And also, he said, the evaluation of the somatic system has been shown scientifically to add a significant dimension to both diagnosis and treatment in the care of patients. However, outside the osteopathic profession, this dimension is not widely understood or utilised. I think the work that these researchers did through these early years was exemplary. Yes, it is old, and of course, I don't think there ever was a research project or study without flaws. However, at the time, this was good science. A number of technique modalities, which are still in use today, such as muscle energy techniques, strain, counter strain, etc., have all been developed using this and were underpinned by this research. In the last 25 years, it has come under some degree of scrutiny, which I believe is appropriate, as all science should be constantly examined and tested. However, some of the criticism based on experiments to reproduce these studies used completely different methodologies, different equipment. In fact, there were so many differences that you really couldn't compare it to the original experiments. Other critiques have been just unscientific and just plain malicious. But we'll debunk these in later podcasts and publications. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. I really enjoy the early years research by Denslow and Kaur, as I think they're so important. And don't forget, if you'd like further information about the Institute of Classical Osteopathy, have a look at our website, which is www.classical-osteopathy.org. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.